This is Free Thought Radio with co-host Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
And this is radio as godless as our Constitution. Hello, all of you godless citizens of planet Earth. I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. And Annie Laurie Gaylor is not here today. Again, she wanted to come, but too many pressing details. The convention this week and the construction. Why am I wearing a hard hat today for this show? Well, they have been demolishing the building next door. The construction of our new building addition is now proceeding. It's very noisy. In fact, if you want to see a really fun video that one of our attorneys made, Andrew Seidel, a time-lapse 70-second video of the entire demolition of the building that's next door to ours, where we're going to expand, go to the Freedom From Religion Foundation's Facebook page. And in fact, I added a little bit of dramatic silent movie music behind it, so you can watch that whole process. It's pretty amazing. This show, Free Thought Radio, is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're the nation's largest organization of non-believers. That's atheists and agnostics. And our primary purpose is to keep religion and government separate. But we are also an educational group educating about the views of the non-believers, atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, whatever we call ourselves. This show is the September 28th, 2013 broadcast. We produce and broadcast right here in Madison, Wisconsin. You can also hear us. You might be listening in other markets, other broadcast areas, such as in Central California, in parts of New York State, in Central Michigan, up in the Grand Rapids, Missouri area, and other places, including in Central Texas, where College Station is there in Texas A&M is in College Station. So welcome to radio that is as godless, as secular as our Constitution. Today we're going to be talking with Guy Harrison. We had him on the show before. Guy is the author of a number of really good books. We talked to him about his book, 50 Reasons People Give for Believing in God. Well, he has a new book out, 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. So you'll enjoy that. And as I told you, Annie Laurie is at the office with the staff planning for the convention this week. And in fact, this show you're listening to is broadcast during that convention with many speakers. And so our time of promotion is done. We are at the Concourse Hotel in Madison, Wisconsin, with hundreds of non-believers. And one of the stars of the convention is the Supreme Court litigant Ellery Shemp, who the Abington versus Shemp 1963 case. And he's talking to us about that decision because this year is the 50th anniversary. That decision came down in June of 1963. And when we introduced Ellery, we found, in fact, he sent us an hour CBS News story that ran that couple of days after the decision. And we pulled out a little bit of clips of video that show Ellery as a young man 50 years ago in his early 20s. Listen to a little bit of that CBS News story with Eric Severide.
Here is CBS News correspondent Eric Severide.
Good evening. 2 days ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down decisions in two cases involving Bible reading and recitation of the Lord's Prayer in the public schools.
This is the home of Mr. and Mrs. Edward Shemp and their three children in Roslyn, Pennsylvania. Ellery Shemp, the oldest child, explains how it all started.
Well, I guess it began when I was a junior in high school. I was in the Abington Senior High School, and in our English class, a group of students had been meeting together and talking over issues of all varieties, religious issues, political issues. It became there's sort of a consensus that the Bible reading and the Lord's Prayer in the public schools was not only undesirable, but in violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. We were concerned with the role that we might play as citizens in building a better world. We were idealists, I'm sure. And in November of 1956, I came to the conclusion that I would make a protest against this. Instead of listening to the Lord's Prayer and the Bible reading, I sat at my desk reading a copy of the Koran, and I did not stand for the Lord's Prayer, and then I stood for the flag salute, as was customary. The reaction, of course, was very immediate. In the classroom, a teacher came to my side and told me that in the future I would have to stand for the Lord's Prayer and pay attention during the Bible reading. And I had to reply that in conscience I could no longer participate in the ceremony, and I was sent to the principal. He sent me to the guidance counselor, for I was clearly in need of psychological help. The guidance counselor and I had a brief chat, and I returned to classes that day. Coming home in the evening, I sat down and wrote a letter to the American Civil Liberties Union, and I stated that I thought the practice was a bad one, probably unconstitutional, and would they be interested in helping?
That letter was received at the Philadelphia branch of the American Civil Liberties Union by Executive Director Spencer Cox.
We never got around to considering it at all until February, when one of our committees, composed mostly of lawyers, took a look at it, and that committee at that time decided that we should not get involved on behalf of Ellery Shemp on the grounds that the issue was not a very important one.
But the Shemps thought it was important.
I believe that I was right very fervently, and I thought that gave me a stand that would overcome all obstacles.
And Ellery was right. He believed he was right. He was consistent. He was brave. He was courageous. And they pursued that to a very strong Supreme Court decision in 1963, removing Bible recitation and prayer from the United States public schools. Another brave hero of the First Amendment is still fighting today, Michael Newdow. Michael Newdow and the Freedom From Religion Foundation are continuing the fight to remove the phrase, "In God We Trust," from our money. I spend the money, I don't trust in God, but my government is telling me that I do. Otherwise, what does that word "we" mean? Well, we just found out that we lost at the lower level in court, and we're going to appeal. Annie Laurie wrote a statement that we put up on our press release last week saying, "Let's hear it for tenacious Mike Newdow. The religious right, which never gives up to unite church and state, has met its equal in tenacity with Michael Newdow." I received an email from Mike last week informing us that a federal judge has slapped down his and our latest challenge of "In God We Trust" on the currency. Mike assured me we'll be appealing shortly on behalf of FFRF, his mother, Rosalind Newdow, who is a coin collector, by the way, and 17 other plaintiffs. Mike, as you know, catapulted into state church separation fame when he won a beautiful ruling by the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in 2002, declaring "Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional in public schools. The memorable words of the Judge Goodwin are worth repeating. "A profession that we are a nation under God is identical to profession that we are a nation under Jesus, or a nation under Vishnu, or a nation under Zeus, or a nation under no God." Goodwin noted that "under God forces school children to swear allegiance to monotheism, impermissibly taking a position on the existence and identity of God." Newdow's surprise win received international coverage, and he even inspired a group of hypocritical members of Congress to scream out, "Under God!" on the steps of the Capitol. And most importantly, he reminded an increasingly amnesiac nation that the original Pledge of Allegiance, written in 1892, was entirely secular. Not until 1954 was God inserted, and thereby ironically dividing one nation indivisible with religion. That ruling, unfortunately, was overturned on a standing technicality by the Supreme Court. Mike first contacted us because we had sued over "In God We Trust," another Johnny-come-lately, first adopted in 1956 and then to appear on currency in 55, paper currency in 57. Our case in Colorado court, argued by Robert R. Tiernan, was also thrown out on standing. Mike credited FFRF's suit with first giving him the idea to challenge "Under God" in the pledge. We've been watching his cases, working with Mike ever since. Of all of the violations we receive by our memberships, "In God We Trust" tops the list. closely followed by Under God in the Pledge. The current suit was filed in New York, alleging that the verbiage is proselytizing, discriminatory, and an establishment of monotheism. Newdow quoted representatives who voted for the addition of those words, In God We Trust, as seeking to use the money to proselytize around the world. Our lawsuit also points out that In God We Trust is discriminatory. It excludes atheists and others who don't believe in one God or any God at all. The ruling by Judge Harold Bayer Jr. said the placement of the phrase doesn't constitute a substantial burden on atheists, but we feel sure that if it read In Allah We Trust, he might have found this a bit irksome for Christian believers. After the decision came down, a woman with a brash voice called our offices to chide us for being part of the lawsuit. Contrary to the judge's denial that it's a religious endorsement, this woman categorically states that the motto proves that America is a Christian nation. Aren't you afraid that by denying Jesus Christ, you'll go to hell? She asked. Annie Laurie couldn't resist asking, aren't you afraid that by denying Zeus, you're going to end up in Hades? And then she hung up. While there's critics of these kinds of lawsuits, it should be noted that we secularists have nothing to lose over this matter. We're grateful for the tireless pro bono work of Michael Newdow to restore secularism to our government mottos and the pledge. Mike, we'll see you in appeals court. So we'll talk more after the break about In God We Trust, and after this, in the second half, we'll talk with Guy P. Harrison, author of the book 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. I'm Dan Barker, and this is Free Thought Radio.
This nation gives us the freedom to worship if we must. But then why does all my money have to say In God We Trust? It seems religion is an offer I can't refuse. Is everybody crazy? I've got those free thinker blues.
Why does all my money have to say In God We Trust? It's an offer I can't refuse. I'm Dan Barker, and this is Free Thought Radio. We've been talking about the phrase In God We Trust, which we are still trying to get removed from our currency because it is inaccurate and it is divisive. But in the state of Wisconsin, there's been a bill introduced to put it on license plates. One of our staff attorneys, Patrick Elliott, went to testify this past week opposing Assembly Bill 244 in Wisconsin. Here's just a little bit of Patrick's testimony that he read. Wisconsin Assembly Bill 244 would create a religious and exclusionary Wisconsin license plate. Elected officials should not use their government position and influence to promote their religious views. The phrase doesn't represent all Wisconsinites. To be accurate, it would have to say, In God, some of us trust. Nearly a fifth of adult Americans and one in three young adults is now non-religious. 23% of military identify as non-religious. State legislators are elected to represent all citizens, including those who do not believe in a monotheistic God or any gods. Both supporters and opponents of the bill recognize that In God We Trust is a religious statement. The fact that a portion of the fees would go to the state's Veterans Trust Fund doesn't mitigate the problems with a religious plate. As the Supreme Court has said, sponsorship of a religious message is impermissible because it sends the ancillary message to members of the audience who are non-adherents that they are outsiders, not full members of the political community, and accompanying message to adherents that they are insiders, they're favored members of the political community. The history of the motto In God We Trust evidences no secular purpose. On the contrary, it was first adopted in 1956 during the Cold War as a reaction to the purported godlessness of communism. E pluribus unum, meaning out of many come one, was the entirely secular motto selected by Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. A private group can already utilize the normal process available for special group plates. This bill, however, specially approves an In God We Trust plate. Such special approval was a primary reason that an I Believe religious plate in South Carolina was ruled unconstitutional. The Wisconsin State Assembly should respect the beliefs and non-belief of all citizens and reject Assembly Bill 244. That's part of the testimony that staff attorney Patrick Elliott gave before the State Assembly this past week in Wisconsin. So we keep fighting. We keep fighting the war against religion and government. But we can also fight the religious war against science. Let's go out of this segment today by listening to Roy Zimmerman's really funny song, not Turn Off the TV, but the attitude that many people have to turn off the Hubble. This is from his 2006 album, Faulty Intelligence.
They put a telescope in outer space so Mother Earth could look about her space. And what she saw was rather shocking. 'Twas Stephen Hawking, and he was talking about expanding universal understanding. And that telescope forced her to contemplate as well as cope with cosmological conjecture and how that affects your morning commute. And faced with this dilemma, I ask you, what on earth's a Mother Earth to do? Turn off the Hubble, stay out of trouble, live in a bubble with Barney Rubble. Pull the plug and watch it plummet down. No need to shoot, we'll simply dumb it down. Before it spoils our education with information and fills our heads up with a lot of that erroneous errata. More importantly, we got a brand new paradigm. NASA is singing, can you spare a dime? And there's a starving astrophysicist. We won't need his assistance anymore. 'Cause from now on we spell intelligence with a silent S-C-I-E-N-S. Turn off the Hubble, stay out of trouble, live in a bubble with Barney Rubble. Like Barney Rubble, except only double. Dum 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 dum. Now Galileo went way over his head. That's what they said. When he was excommunicated, he was a menace to Genesis, they say. And to this day, we say to that, yea, verily, yea. And so we sent the presidentialist of every brilliant fundamentalist, which some might call oxymoronical, like the Times and Chronicle, and all them eggheads at the college with degrees in Big Bangology. They ought to just apologetically acknowledge that our destiny is manifestly Charlton Heston-y. Let's saddle up and send a man to Mars. Where better than to Mars? The planet from which some would tell us men have come. And incidentally, we've discovered that an expanding universe makes us look fat. Turn off the Hubble, stay out of trouble, live in a bubble with Barney Rubble. Turn off the Hubble, live in a bubble like Barney Rubble, except only double. Dum 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 the shrubble, turn off the hubble.
And that's Roy Zimmerman singing Turn Off the Hubble, his own song from his album Faulty Intelligence. I'm Dan Barker, and this is Free Thought Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking with Guy Harrison about his new book, 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. Stay tuned for more radio that is as godless as our Constitution.
This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And Annie Laurie is not here today. She wanted to come, but there was just too many details with our annual convention and with the building construction that just started this week. Our building is being pounded. In fact, in a day and a half, the building next door to us, which we bought and are demolishing so that we can expand, took a day and a half to bring the whole thing down, and it's pretty amazing. Andrew Seidel made a minute and a half live-action video of it. You can go to the Freedom From Religion Foundation Facebook page and watch this cute thing of a building completely being destroyed by the giant hand of God, you know. Why is it that acts of God are always bad things like that? But anyway, Annie Laurie will be back with us next week. And today, as we announced earlier, we have on the phone with us from San Diego, from Southern California, Guy P. Harrison. He was on our show before. We talked with him about his book, 50 Reasons People Give for Believing in God. That's a fun book, and that was a fun show. And he has a number of new books out, including one we want to talk about today, called 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. Guy P. Harrison has authored 5 books that promote science and reason. He is himself a former science teacher, and he's also a journalist who's won some awards. He'll be speaking in New Zealand next month at the Science Teller Festival, and Random House has named his newest book, which isn't out yet, I don't think. It's called Think, Why You Should Question Everything, as recommended reading for all first-year university students. So, Guy, welcome back to Free Thought Radio.
Hi, Dan. It's great to be back. Thank you.
So what a guy. You've been busy. Guy is quite a guy. So tell us about this 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian, and then later I want to ask about your new book. But why did you write this book?
Yeah, well, I tackled two things at once with this book. For one, I wanted to present a really easy-to-read, plain English skeptical exploration of the most basic Christian claims, the most important things that swirl around this whole concept of the Christian religion. And I did that in a way that believers and non-believers both can get, you know, fresh perspectives on these challenging ways that you can analyze the claims. And then the other, probably the more important part of the book, the goal of the book, is to show Christians what's really going on inside the minds of non-believers. Because far too many Christians are just locked into this conclusion where they think that every skeptic of Christianity is angry at God, that they really believe, but they're just rejecting God because they want to live an immoral life, or they're too arrogant, or they want to worship science, or something like that. Or they had a bad experience in religion, so they were just turned off from it.
And well, I used to preach that, you know, when I was a minister. You know,
exactly. I know you did. Yeah,
what reasons would you have for believing unless you have these personal psychological reasons, right?
Yeah, I think, and part of the problem, as I get to in the book, that because so many of them have been raised in this belief system, it's so deep within their emotions that they really have a hard time imagining how someone could simply walk away from it and say it doesn't make sense. And so I hope that this book, and so far it's been successful. I've been getting really good feedback from Christians, including Christian pastors. And so my hope is that even if a typical Christian reader is not, you know, deconverted or anything like that, at least they're going to have a better understanding of what skeptics are thinking when they think about Christianity.
Let me read some of those 50 questions. We can't read them all, but some of them include, what are miracles? Why isn't everyone a Christian? Will the end times never end? Is faith a good thing? Have you read the Bible? Is the U.S. a Christian nation? Does the complexity of life reveal an intelligent designer? What about all the other gods? Does Christianity make sense? Why don't you talk about that question? Does Christianity make sense?
Yeah, that's chapter one, and that's the most basic question of all. Does this thing make sense? And what happens a lot of times with skeptics, that's one of the first things they tackle. That's one of the things that starts nagging at them. They say, you know what, they're sitting there in the pew listening to a preacher, or they're just reading the Bible or thinking about Jesus and Christianity, and they've got this first question. Does this all make sense? Is it true? Can it be true? Should it be true? And then from there, they go on to all these more complex challenges, you know, problems with the Bible, the problem of evil in the world, all these things, they get down the road. And I think a lot of skeptics of Christianity sort of forget that very first question of, wait a minute, does the very basic core of this religion make any sense?
Well, does it? If it doesn't, well, no, then why not?
It doesn't, because, or at least it doesn't seem to make any sense. And so far, I haven't heard any good explanations of it. But I present in the book the most stripped-down, basic kind of description of Christianity that I could come up with that didn't immediately splinter off into, you know, thousands of denominations. You know, I actually consulted a pastor on it. And so I just got the basic thing of, you know, God is real. He sent his son, who is also himself, to earth to die for us because we're all imperfect beings and we needed to be saved. So that's the basic thing. And if you believe in Jesus and you accept him in your heart and all that, then you're okay. You're going to go to heaven. Well, that basic claim, so simple, but you can't just speed right by it. You need to break it down and really think about it. Like, first of all, what are we being saved from? We're being saved from the God who's also saying that he's going to save us. I mean, he's like, you know, Jesus is knocking on our door saying, I'm here to save you. And you say, save me from what? And he says, from me, because we're not under any threat apart from him. And then the problem, probably the biggest problem of all is why? Why would we need this bizarre human sacrifice to save us from our original sin, which is another weird concept? You're born imperfect and worthy of condemnation. That's strange. But why would we have to do this? We figured out, most societies figured out a long time ago that tossing virgins into volcanoes and, you know, ripping the heart out of some guy on top of a temple is not really the best way to go about business. It's not really necessary or nice. So we stopped doing it. But yet, that's the core of Christianity, this weird human sacrifice of Jesus. Why? Why wouldn't God just forgive us? Is he bound by some sort of rules that, you know, he has to follow? What's going on?
Well, I used to preach from the Bible, of course, that says without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sins. And so that's really an archaic, primitive idea. But God has anger and his law has been violated by our free will, violating his holiness. And so there has to be, in order for God's anger to be appeased, there has to be some bloodshed, like animal sacrifice or whatever. And so since that rule is in place, you and I are guilty by our free will of having chosen wrongly and offended God and corrupted our lives. Therefore, some blood's got to be shed somewhere. So he picks his son, who's free of any sin, and he sheds his blood, which is sacrificial atonement. So I used to preach that, see, Jesus paid the price for us. He canceled our bill for us, and now we're free because God's anger has been satisfied. That's kind of roughly my theological answer. What do you say to that?
Yeah. Well, my point is that what's with this barbaric blood stuff? I mean, it's only the 21st century. You know, we've barely come out of the trees and the caves. But most of us on earth have figured out that to go out and kill a cow or a goat, slice its, you know, throat and all that, it's just not, most people in America today would be disgusted by that and call the cops and want somebody arrested if we did that to a dog or a cat. But yet this blood, this bizarre thing of someone must bleed so that we can be forgiven. I mean, it's a barbaric concept that, you know, you could understand it, a story, a belief system that people in the Iron Age and Bronze Age came up with. You could see that. Okay, fine. But it makes no sense for modern people. And we have to judge this by modern eyes if people are going to say, hey, this applies to us today.
You know, some scholars have suggested that the tribe of Levi, which is 1/12 of the nation of Israel, they didn't do any work. They were set aside to be the priestly caste. And if they wanted to eat, they needed sacrifices from the other 11 tribes. So once a year, they would come in and they would have to kill the animals and shed the blood, but then the priest got the food. So in a sense, that was kind of their national taxation, I suppose, their way of redistributing the wealth. But then it turned into a theological dogma.
Right. Always an angle.
So another question you have in the book, is it rude to ask?
Yeah, that's actually a very popular chapter. I've gotten a lot of feedback from that. And what that's all about, I'm just saying, you know, this idea of religion being out of bounds, that you shouldn't challenge it. You know, people like you, Richard Dawkins, are forever being called militant atheists, angry activists. And I always chuckle at that. And I say, why? You know, like when you appear on CNN and you're bickering with some guy who's a, you know, a Christian or something over some monument or whatever, you know, people react to you as this horrible monster who's just really out of control. But if you pause, if you rewind, if you listen to what you or Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens even used to say, you'll see they're not really saying anything. Words are not bullets. These are ideas. These are thoughts. And when you challenge a concept, you challenge an idea, that in itself is not rude. It's you can do it in rude ways, I guess. You could call names as you do it and scream, I guess. But just the basic idea of asking questions and challenging a belief is not bad. And Christians are the ones in America who are always bringing up religion anyway. Look at politics. You know, recent election. Every politician talks about God, the Bible, how important faith is to them. Well, that's fine. If they bring it up, then we should be able to ask meaningful questions about it. I want to know, you know, during the last presidential election, we should have asked more questions of Mitt Romney about Mormonism. You know, there are many questions he should have answered.
Oh, that would have been rude.
Yeah, well, that's the point. It's not rude, you know. And Obama, I mean, Obama brings up the Bible and God. Well, let's ask him, what parts of the Bible does he really believe and which parts does he reject and why? What is the reasoning going on in his mind? If he's going to bring it up, we should be able to ask him. And it's not mean, because they say that Christianity is profoundly important to themselves and to society. Okay, great. Well, let's talk about it. Because it's clear, Christianity and religion, for whatever good they do, they cause a lot of problems.
They should be complimented for us asking those questions. We're talking with Guy P. Harrison. He's the author of a new book called 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. And we'll continue this line, Guy, when we come back from the break. I'm Dan Barker. Annie Laurie Gaylor is not here today. She'll be here next week. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. It ain't necessarily so. Welcome back to Radio as Godless as Our Constitution. I'm Dan Barker, and this is Free Thought Radio. And we're continuing our talk with Guy P. Harrison about his new book, exciting new book, just came out this year. It's called 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian. And it's got a lot of meat in it, but when you open it, it doesn't look imposing. It's not like a bunch of equations and all that. It's just an accessible, like talking to a friend. There's a few pictures. Here's a picture of Benny Hinn doing a faith healing, the power of the ministry of faith healers and all that. So Guy, you picked these 50 questions, I suppose, because it's a nice round number. But one of the questions I was intrigued by, and when I was a preacher, I used to say this, that, you know, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are all corrupt. They have never done a good thing. One of the questions you ask in your book is, can atheists be trusted?
Yeah, it's a terrible problem in the U.S. especially. I'll tell you real quick. I've been in contact with a pastor, an active pastor, for a few years now, and he's sort of evolved into an atheist, but he's still a pastor, and he's trying to transition out of that career now, something you can relate with. And he told me, I asked him, I said, you know, you're like the ultimate insider right now. What do your peers, your congregation, what do they think about atheists? And, man, it was shocking. He said that they view atheists as the lowest of the low, the least trustworthy, the most undesirable fools and idiots and corrupt people imaginable. And that's fascinating because it matches up perfectly with scientific studies that have been done. I mean, studies have found that in the U.S., even after the 9/11 attacks and all the PR problems that Muslims have had, Muslims still rank significantly higher than atheists as far as Who would you want your daughter to marry or your son to marry? Who would you vote for in an election? Americans are far more willing to vote for a Muslim or a gay, even though they're very unpopular with many people, a Muslim or gay, than an atheist. And that's just absolutely incredible. It, even one study found that a significant number of Americans associate atheists with rapists at a much higher degree than they do other unpopular groups. And all that gets down to there's this element of trust. They just feel they can't trust us because we don't have that leash around our neck that's being held by a God. We don't have that governor inside our head that's controlling us and slowing us down. So we're just these loose cannons.
Well, yeah,
of course that's not true. Though.
Like if we don't have this fear and respect for divine punishment and hell, then there's nothing stopping us from being dishonest and doing whatever we want. We don't have any moral standard or moral breaks on our lives. I used to preach that, but even though that's a prevalent attitude among believers, is it true? Are atheists untrustworthy?
No, and don't take my opinion for it. Look at the world. Look at the United States and look at the world. In the U.S., the least religious states have the least crime, okay? The more intensely religious states, like Louisiana, for example, I think is probably first or second most religious state, and that's based on what people say and actual church attendance. Yet, it has one of the highest homicide rates. It's got one of the highest incarceration rates. I mean, so clearly, the religion thing doesn't really make everybody so trustworthy.
Well,
and the lack of religion doesn't. And look at the Scandinavian countries. Very high rates of atheism. Very low rates of crime.
Well,
what's going on?
The conclusion is simple then, Guy. Christians can't be trusted.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think... Maybe none of us can be trusted.
You know I'm joking. You know I was joking. It was just following from what they would say. Yeah. So, there's so much good in here. Another question in your book, one of the 50 questions: does Jesus answer prayers?
Yeah, in that chapter, I briefly touch on the standard sort of responses, the fact that every religion has this claim within it of successful prayers. You know, Hindus say it, Muslims say it, and they all cite it as proof that their religion is the one true, and it's no different from Christianity. You know, the ancient Greeks prayed, and they got, you know, their prayers were answered according to them. So that's a problem right there. But I tried to go at something a little more emotional that I hope would make an impact on readers. And it came from my travels around the world. I've been to like six continents, many, many countries. And one of the things I paid close attention to and wrote about was extreme poverty. And what I noticed everywhere I went, Nepal, India, Africa, the Middle East, very, very poor people tend to be very, very religious. And it's interesting because they pray a lot. They pray hard. They pray passionately. And these areas of the developing world where there's extreme poverty, that's the most has the most horrendous rates of child mortality. I mean, each year about 9 million children under the age of 5 die from malnutrition or preventable diseases. They just die. And I thought about that, and I said, you know, in almost every one of those cases, it's not just a baby dying. It's not just a statistic. There's a story with each death. There's usually a mother or a father holding that child, crying, hoping that child can hold on and not die. And at the same time, what are these very, very religious people likely doing? They're probably praying and praying hard.
And their prayers are not working.
Yeah, and guess what? I mean, I give statistics. The worst countries that you want to be a mother with a young child in are the most intensely religious countries. The countries with the least religion, with the lowest rates of religion, they're the best places in the world to be if you're a mother with a newborn child, because your baby's probably going to be okay. Now, of course, that has to do with, you know, medical infrastructure and all that. But God should not be constrained by that kind of stuff. That's human, mundane stuff here down on the ground. You know, so if a prayer, what prayer is more, could be more sincere, more meaningful, more worthy of action than a mother's prayer for her suffering and dying baby that she's holding in her arms, a baby in agony, dying of dysentery or whatever? I mean, that is one prayer that should be answered. According to the Bible, your prayer will be answered. It's guaranteed.
Well, there's empirical proof then that the prayers to Jesus or any other deity don't work. We're almost out of time, Guy. I'm sorry. This is so much fun. But I wanted to give you a moment to talk about your new book. I think it's called Think. And is that available? Can people get it? And what's it about?
Yeah, it's available for pre-order right now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It'll be out November 5th in bookstores everywhere. It's really a fun book. It's called Think, Why You Should Question Everything. And it's kind of a grand tour of the human brain, how to understand the way it tricks us and trips us up just by natural processes, the way we see, hear, and remember our experiences, what we need to be aware of and the biases that we have. We have so many things going on in our head that most people are not aware of, but you need to be. Otherwise, you're going to constantly be tripped up by scams, silly stuff, crazy, kooky things. And you don't want that. You want that good protective shield of skeptical thinking. You want to be able to navigate your way through this nutty world as best you can so you can get to the good stuff, the real stuff.
Well,
that's what it's all about.
The Bible Bible tells people to go ahead and think. So they should welcome a new book like this. Sorry we're out of time, Guy. Guy P. Harrison is the author of 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian in his brand new book, Think, Why You Should Question Everything. Thanks for being a wonderful guest today, Guy. And thank you, David. David McCann is producing and engineering our show here in Madison, Wisconsin. You can listen to the archives or sign up for the podcast at ffrf.org/news/radio. Become a member of the Freedom from Religion Foundation. You can support our legal work and our broadcasts and our educational activities. Call us at 1-800-335-4021. And Annie Laurie always likes to end the show, and she'll be back next week. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday